Hello, friends. I have received an unprecedented number of emails and requests asking me to comment, frankly asking for help, about how to deal with the nationalism and the rise of angry, patriotic Christianity. This has been sparked by the pictures that we saw of Donald Trump holding up a Bible in front of a church in Washington, D.C., where he used the arm of the state to clear peaceful protesters who were not breaking curfew and using gas and rubber bullets to wreak actual physical bodily harm on people in order to have a photo op holding up a Bible. And this event, for some reason, of all the things that Donald Trump has done and said, I can tell you it has set people off in a way I haven't noticed before after 4 years of having this person as one of the most prominent public spokespeople for the evangelical power arm. It has actually been this event which has just caused dismay amongst so many people. So people have been asking me to comment or to help. I thought that I would record this episode or this podcast rather than write, because perhaps other people can hear this, and I'm sure. I know, because the emails and the questions you sent me were the same ones from lots of different places, from Australia, from Canada, from Britain, and from America. I have had similar requests and similar notes of bewilderment, dismay, lack of faith, loss of faith, anger, rage, genuine hurt and love, and an attempt to reach across the divide. I am telling you, I have never seen anything quite like this, and this is coming at the bottom, or at the, this was like the low point, the nadir of the protests, the violent protests in America right now and spreading across the world in the wake of the killing of George Floyd by a white police officer in Minneapolis. And it's been an absolute tinderbox, the coronavirus lockdown, the populations going insane, even well-meaning people just losing their minds over being locked down for so long. And then you add to the mix actual agents who don't mean well, who are actively trying to cause disruption and fear and hate. And you get an absolute tinderbox for this event. You get the end of the road for African Americans, end of the road for people who are just dismayed. It's a bad world. It is bad. It's dark out there. I've never seen anything quite this bad. And I'm somebody who's written and published stuff on the Nazis. And we're going to talk about this in a bit. Okay, I'm going to gather myself. Perhaps a little bit of housekeeping. There'll be some people who don't know who I am. Perhaps you will have just been sent this link because it's going to touch on stuff that you've been asking about. My name is Stephen Backhouse. I am an academic and a teacher and a theologian who specializes in political theology and also specifically in nationalism and patriotism. I run a little podcast project called The Bible Study at the Beginning of the World, in which I've been taking people through half-hour episodes, going chapter by chapter through the Gospel of Mark and then the Acts of the Apostles, looking at the politics and the social and political aspects of those New Testament books. So some people listening to this will have already been familiar with my voice and my story through that podcast. Other people might have found me through, I did some work with Nomad podcast on nationalism and patriotism and violence. I've been interviewed on television, radio, podcasts, and in print on these subjects. I'm an author of several books. I've written church history books. I've written, published a book on Christian nationalism. I've published a biography of Søren Kierkegaard, who was a Danish philosopher who was opposed to nationalism. I have a couple of master's degrees which were focused on Christian nationalists who were theologians, and so I was analyzing their subject and picking apart their thought. I have a doctorate from the University of Oxford, which again is on nationalism and Christian nationalism. I don't say this to boast about it, I'm not bragging. I mean, my having multiple master's degrees and a doctorate doesn't make me right. God knows, I'm wrong all the time, and I love to admit it. But it does make me, statistically, probably the most qualified person you know on the subject of Christian nationalism. And so my opinion is earned. I've been earning it for 20 years. I've been speaking with nationalists, I've been observing and living in nationalist environments. I've been teaching and traveling around in universities, in churches, in businesses. This is what I do. So I'm very happy to share it with you, especially because so many of my friends and people I love are asking for help. So I'm going to try and give what I can. And you can take it or leave it. And if you don't like what I'm saying, fair enough. You can always send me an email. You can always chat with me. But be aware, I am only interested in talking with people of peace, fellow travelers. And if you have genuine questions, then I'm so happy to talk with you. But if all you're going to do is just defend Trump or shout patriotic slogans at me or quote random Bible verses that you think are your knockdown arguments, just be aware that I've already heard all this stuff. I've weighed it and found it wanting. And I'll explain why as this little talk goes on, I think. The other thing about me, you can hear my accent. I'm a Canadian who, when I was 19, I moved to the UK, to England. And I've been living in England now for 25 years. And in fact, it was my story of growing up in a very conservative, evangelical, conservative politically and Christianly. I grew up amongst people who called themselves fundamentalists. They self-identified as fundamentalists. They self-identified as conservatives. I grew up in that culture. And then when I moved to England just for an adventure, for fun, when I was 19, I ended up being around a group of people who called themselves Christians but didn't check all the same political and social boxes that I had been taught that one should check if one is to be a real Christian. They weren't tub-thumping patriots, they weren't gun-loving nuts, they didn't all agree about abortion, they didn't all agree about homosexual marriage or ordination, they didn't all believe in six-day creationism, they didn't all believe in the rapture, they didn't all vote for the red team so the blue team wouldn't win, or for the blue team so the red team wouldn't win. I discovered in England a little church filled with people that didn't all check the same boxes and yet were united in fellowship of the love of Jesus. And this was a world-changing, game-changing event for me, because this was not the sort of culture I had grown up amongst. I had grown up amongst people where if you went into a room, you could guarantee, of all those list of boxes that I just mentioned, you could guarantee which ones were going to get checked and which ones were not, and which ones should be checked and which ones shouldn't be. And you knew who they would all be voting for. The kind of people I grew up around often expressed, I had friends who wished they were American so they could vote Republican. So this was the world I grew up in. And then moving to England just changed, opened up my world a bit. And that's what actually set me on the path to studying the work that I did, because I discovered Kierkegaard, who was a Danish philosopher, who has written a lot about the difference between Christendom and Christianity, or perhaps better yet, being a disciple of Jesus and Christendom. And by Christendom, he didn't mean the official relationship between church and state. He meant the cultural backdrop of Christianity, the people who talk about Christian nations and let's make America Christian again, or let's make Britain Christian again, those kind of people, or this is a Christian nation, or our founding fathers were Christian, all that stuff. That is Christendom. So it doesn't really have to do with the law of the land. It has to do with the culture of the place, with the imagination or the shared furniture, the shared mental furniture of a place. If that has been Christianized, what does that do to your awareness of Jesus and his way? And this was the event. Kierkegaard really helped me put language to what I was experiencing, which was that I was living in a nation where I was kind of dislodged from my home group, my home nation, and I was forced to be thinking again what it was to be a follower of Jesus, even though all the politics and the social habits didn't match up. So then I studied, because of Kierkegaard, I studied philosophy and theology at university as an undergraduate, and then I did the graduate work, which I described. And since then, I've been teaching. I used to work for a number of, I've worked for a number of different organizations and seminaries and theology colleges over the years. Most recently, WTC, and before that, St. Melitus, both in the UK. And I'm now the director of Tent Theology, which is a traveling theological enterprise where I get invited to come and live with churches or groups for a weekend or a week at a time, helping to open up space for theology within the local worshiping communities. And the idea is that you shouldn't need to leave your worshiping community in order to think Christianly about your own Christianity. But as I say, my main area is actually the political theology of it, the way that the church is an alternative politics, the way that the earliest Christians were thought of themselves as and were seen to be political adjutants, subversive, dangerous. They were seen to be turning the whole world upside down. They were seen to be agents of another kingdom, not instigators of a new religion. And so this is the ideas that animate my imagination, and this is what brought me to thinking about nationalism. 4 years ago, my wife and I moved to California so that my wife could study at Bethel Church, which is the very well-known charismatic church which runs a ministry course. And my wife was very interested in wanting to observe. She'd seen good things coming out of Bethel and wanted to observe them. So I went along with her, and I lived in Northern California, deeply red part of the country. I lived in Northern California for a year, and I was there during the rise of Trump and during his election. So I was living in America during the presidential campaign, and then I lived in the States after Trump got elected. And of course, the Bethel Church and their leadership, all their main leadership team are pro-Trump and have lent their name to his cause. As much as possible, they've used their voice and their finances and their other resources to support Trump and the Republican cause. And they're no different in that respect than basically every other most evangelical and most charismatic churches in America. And so we are going to talk about that in a little bit. But I want to make it clear here. I'm just decided in this series of podcasts that I'm going to do that I'm tired of hiding behind language like honor and dishonor. I'm tired of pretending that disagreement doesn't exist. And I'm tired of pretending that if we disagree with somebody that we are now also insulting them. I think that the Bethel leadership team, along with all the other prominent evangelicals in America, as well as any that you might find in Australia or the UK or Germany or wherever, I think by supporting Trump and lending their support to him, they are demonstrating a failure of Christian imagination, and they're showing their true colors of what they really do believe in, despite their sentimental worship and despite their language. And I'm going to mention this more clearly as we start to deal with some of the questions that came in. But you have to hear that I am an insider here. I spent my resources, I quit my job to go and live with the Bethel people. I was not some cynical, arms-crossed academic judging them. I was fully involved and immersed in that environment. I love worship. I love going after prophetic words. I love healing. And going after healing. I believe in the Holy Spirit as an active personal presence today. I believe in King Jesus and his way and his rule. And my charge here is that I don't think that Bethel believes in King Jesus. I think they've shown by their actions and their allegiances that they believe more in nationalism and militarism and make America great again than they do in the reign and rule of Jesus the King. And these are big charges that I'm making, but I'm not going to do them using insults. I'm not going to try and shame people. Ironically, I'm not going to use the same tactic that President Trump uses every single day in the messages that he himself is 100% responsible for and in his tweets. I'm not going to call my opponents losers. I'm not going to say they're weak. I'm not going to say they're morons. I'm not going to call them dogs. I'm not going to compare my penis size to theirs. I expect I'll get through this entire podcast without boasting about grabbing anyone's pussy. And if you are a Trump supporter who is somehow offended by my crude language, I don't even know what to say to you now. Congratulations, you've helped to create a world in which quoting verbatim the President of the United States comes with a language warning which is unsuitable for children. One of my friends, who I actually met when I was in Bethel, one of the fellow students there, she writes to me and she asks, how do I have a conversation with Christians who loved the picture of Trump holding up the Bible? Is it worth my time? How do I build bridges? Okay, I chose to read this question first because it is indicative of many of the sorts of questions that I get. People just seeking, how do we cross this bridge, this chasm, between my Christianity, which I just seem to see as obviously true and pointing towards one frame of reference, and other people who also call themselves Christian, who are coming to the exact opposite conclusion. Here's the headline, and then we'll fill in the blanks later. But the headline is, stop using the word Christian. We need to unwean ourselves from this label. It's becoming utterly meaningless, if you think about it. For quite some time now, the word Christian can cover sets of actions and beliefs that are diametrically opposed to each other. For huge swathes of population, in North America and in Europe and in Africa, for example, the word Christian denotes a type of ethnic identity, a type of ingrained sets of habits and cultural mores that you're born into. For a lot of other people, the word Christian means a set of beliefs and approaches towards the world, which, as I say, are actually diametrically opposed to other groups who also call themselves Christian. You can call yourself a Christian and support all sorts of things. You cannot call yourself a follower of the way of Jesus and support all sorts of things. And I think that we need to find the new way of speaking, which in fact is just the old way, because that's what the first followers of Jesus called themselves. They said they were followers on the way. And I think that this is something we need to start doing again. Stop using the word Christian. Unclench yourself from the bad habit. The word is meaningless now. One of the friends who wrote to me said, sometimes it feels now like calling yourself a Christian is to participate in a hate crime. And you know what? He's right. Calling yourself Christian in so many different environments is to identify yourself with some of the worst ideas currently active in the world today, and we have to face that. And if our measuring line is the way of Jesus, we are going to be able to determine what is right, what is true, what is noble. Set your minds on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Put your minds on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. And if other forms of life, and if other sentiments, and if other expressions don't match the way of Jesus, then we can discount them. We are allowed to. We're not discounting the human being who did it, but we are allowed to say, it doesn't walk like a duck. It doesn't talk like a duck. It doesn't look like a duck. So I think we're allowed to say it's not a duck. We need to take seriously Kierkegaard's charge that Christendom has done away with Christianity. It no longer exists. And you might hear that and think it's just some sort of rhetoric, or maybe he's exaggerating to score a cheap point. But what if it's true? What if the forms of life and the culture that you, when you got converted, or you think that you got converted into, what if those forms of life are shaped far more by what the nation needs or what your culture thinks it needs than by the way of Jesus? And in fact, this is what happens all the time. This isn't a minority event. This is the majority. The majority of people who call themselves Christians are animated and excited by ideas that are quite often diametrically opposed to the way of Jesus. And this is where the critique of patriotism and national identity comes in. Because Christendom, which has done away with Christianity, Christendom is the official culture. It's not a church-state legal system. It's the culture. It's the culture that's been baptized. It's the culture that's been Christianized. It's the fact that you are born into a world in which everybody around you checks the same boxes. And so conversion into that world is conversion into that society. And we've forgotten or failed to notice that in the New Testament, following the way of Jesus puts you on a collision course precisely with those elements that are shared by the common society. Being a follower of Jesus in the New Testament sets you against common sense, against the sense we all share in common. Whereas for most people today, conversion into Christianity is conversion or entry into a group in which you start to adopt their shared norms and values. And where do these shared norms and values come from? Are they being based on a logical or in any other way commitment to the following the way of Jesus? Do they show a high degree of seeking peace? Do they seek to not clutch tightly to their rightful goods, even when it's rightfully theirs? Do they exhibit an open-handed generosity towards foreigners? Do they show a lack of attempt to gain riches? Do they show a priority for the poor? Do they show a high commitment to not using violence to get what they need or to solve a problem? This is the way of Jesus. It's not rocket science. You don't need a theology degree. It's not hard to understand. It is just hard to do, which is where the idea that the church should be a political, alternative political society comes in. That the church or the set of people who are following on the way of Jesus are meant to help each other do these things. They help each other give money to the poor so that then they can be supported in turn. They help each other lay down their lives for each other. They help each other seek peace rather than violence. This is what the point of the church is meant to be, but this is not what we find. What we actually find, don't we, is that the churches that we're a part of don't actually like Jesus very much. Sure, they sing about him and they talk about him, but they don't actually like him very much. He doesn't show up in their emotional and intellectual horizon. And you can see this happen all the time, especially around the areas of violence. Well, think of these three things: foreigners, violence, lethal violence, and the acquisition of riches. Think of these three things. Now, Jesus had quite a lot to say about these things. He was resolutely pro-foreigner. He was always crossing over boundaries in order to reach the others. He was invading temples in order to let this house be a house of prayer for all nations. He was moving into Samaritan villages. If you want to know more about this, go and listen to my Mark podcast on the Gospel of Mark. But Jesus was resolutely pro-foreigner, and he bounded over boundaries all the time. He was always breaking boundaries. And anytime somebody set up some kind of purity law, there was never a purity law that Jesus didn't meet, that he didn't cross over to the other side of. He embraced ethnic impurity to an astonishingly radical degree. He crossed over every boundary that is presented to him in the Gospels. Think about the way money works. The acquisition of riches, the storing up of riches, the common sense building of a nest egg. These are things that the lending of money in order at interest. These are the foundations of capitalism. This is the foundations of the sort of common sense American dream. And Jesus was resolutely opposed to all of these things. Think of violence and lethal violence. There is no way you can make Jesus a poster boy for military recruitment, for intentional lethal police violence, for capital punishment. You cannot make Jesus in any way a proponent of these things. For followers of Jesus, killing a human being to solve a problem is off the table. But these are three things that nations need. Nations need high boundaries and a sense of suspicion or superiority towards foreigners. Nations require the insider-outsider language. They require boundaries and walls and all that other stuff. America, for example, requires the capitalism and a system of usury, a system of lending for interest. Our system, our Western system, actually needs us to be materialistic. It needs us to buy things we don't need. It requires that we continually spend and consume. And there's lots of material I can give you on that as well. But let's just take this as my headline. It requires us to act in ways that are diametrically opposed to anything Jesus said or did. And these are all the things that a nation needs. And this is why I say the church, or the Christians today, are far more, their imagination is far more shaped by the way of the nation than by the way of Jesus. And you'll see this all the time whenever you're getting into any debate or if you want to read their own works. And again, read the things that they want you to see. Go and find a blog or read a book or read a chapter by a conservative American defending the use of lethal violence, for example. I absolutely guarantee you that what they will do is, if they are Christian, they might mention Jesus at the beginning, and it will be something like, yes, we know Jesus said, turn the other cheek, but you can't run a nation that way. And then they will mine the Old Testament text, or maybe they'll go and find some mysterious and obscure verse in the book of Revelation or something like that, or they'll go to Romans 13, which we'll probably have to talk about in a bit. But Jesus is only mentioned by Christians when they are trying to disagree with him. This is the thing that once you notice it, you can't unnotice it. And I have marked, for example, thousands, not exaggeration, I have marked thousands of essays, undergraduate theology essays, and it, without fail, when they are asked an assignment question defending the use of military or capital punishment or lethal violence, they will always do this as well. You'd be surprised how often self-confessed Christians do not mention Jesus at all. And in any case, when they do mention him, it's always to disagree with him or to find exceptions to the rule. And the exceptions are always to do, basically, with patriotism. We can't follow the way of Jesus because you can't run a country that way. And they're right. You can't run a country on the Sermon on the Mount. You can't run a country by the fruits of the Spirit. You can damn well try and run a country based on the Old Testament Ten Commandments, which is what we see. Historically, we have seen that as Christians worked their way through the system and started to become powerful, as Christians started to get their fingers on the levers of power, as they started to be responsible for land and armies and taxes and all the accoutrements that come with running a country, they stop talking about Jesus and they start talking about everything else. And everything else becomes an excuse or a justification for still paying lip service to the Bible, but actually ignoring the way of Jesus. And in fact, the way of Jesus gets mocked. The amounts of times I've seen Trump supporters and Christians, self-confessed Christians, mocking people who are trying to be Christ-like, mocking people who are trying to seek the way of Jesus. So calling yourself a Christian really isn't that much different than just calling yourself a patriot. For a lot of people, right now, today, in America, the word patriotism and the word Christianity are often synonymous. But the earliest Christians thought that patriotism was a vice. They recognized that it wasn't a virtue. They recognized that allegiance to your fatherland, which is where patriotism comes from, pater, your paterland, allegiance to your fatherland and to your father's family, to the ethnic tribes that your inherited traditions you were born into, these were seen as rival claims. In fact, this was what you had to be baptized out of. Baptism means you die to the things of the world that are giving you your identity and that are laying claims to your allegiance, and you're born into allegiance to Jesus, faith in Jesus. And the word faith is the word pistis, which means affiliation and allegiance. Faith in Jesus in the New Testament is a public demonstration of wanting to be with Jesus. It has to do with his kingship. It has to do with his kingdom. And when you repent and be baptized in the New Testament, you are saying no to the other forms of life, and you are dying to those things, and then you are being born again or raised up into a new form of life, which has to do with faith following the kingship of Jesus. But this is the stuff, like I said, you don't see this happen. You don't see this preach. When I was in Bethel for a year. I heard the Sermon on the Mount preached once. And that wasn't preached by a guy from the Bethel environment. It was preached from a guy coming from Europe, a guest speaker. And I'm not saying that these people are against the Sermon on the Mount. What I'm saying is, pay attention. What is on their shelf? What's in their mental Rolodex? What's in their folder? When they reach for something, what do they pull out? And you cannot be a good patriot and take the Sermon on the Mount seriously. You cannot actually be a good citizen and be a follower of Jesus. You can't be a reliable citizen, I should say. You can love your neighbor. It takes a mind already gripped by patriotism to miss how Jesus says in this, the parable of the Good Samaritan, how Jesus says that love of neighbor is in the face of love of the co-nationalist. Your person who shares your national identity, the Levite and the priest, they're the good patriots. They're the ones who share all your ethnic and heritage markers. They are not the good neighbor. The good neighbor is the hated outsider, the foreigner, the Samaritan. And Jesus tells the story as a deliberate attempt to wrestle away the idea that your good neighbor was also your co-nationalist. And as I say, you've got to watch, for our imaginations have been colonized by patriotism. The idea that being a Christian might make you a less dependable citizen rather than a more dependable citizen is unimaginable to most Christians today. They cannot see how this could be true. I was speaking to a man in Bethel. His name is Dan Farrelly, and I like Dan Farrelly, but I was speaking to him, and he said that if somebody came to him and said, the Lord's called me to be a soldier in the U.S. Army, I'd have no problem with it. And I just looked at him and was like, you'd have no problem, not an issue at all, with somebody saying, I'm going to kill my enemies, even though Jesus said, love your enemies. To have no problem with somebody joining the U.S. Army is to have no problem with somebody putting the allegiance of King Jesus under the allegiance to the president, whoever that might be, under the allegiance to a man-made country. All nations, no exception, are founded on principles and practices that are the opposite of anything Jesus said or did. Every single flag in every single nation has at its root or in its history genocide, slavery, tribal antagonism, racism, greed, shoring up goods and taking them out of circulation so that the other people can't get them. There is no exception to this rule. This is the world we're born into. Countries are something that we've been born into, but they are themselves evidence of rebellion against the way of Jesus. And the earliest Christians knew this. They knew that their nations that they were born into, the people groups they were born into, were not good. They knew that they were the forms of life that they had inherited. They knew that they could be redeemed, and they had a sense of redemption for them, but they didn't think they were good in and of themselves. And the vision of the nations in the New Testament is that they get dissolved. I had a good long conversation with Chris Vallotton once, who is, of course, also a famous Bethel speaker. And Chris Vallotton was very, very pro-patriotism, and he thinks that every nation has a part to play. And he very enthusiastically holds open his Bible and goes to the verse in Revelation where it says Jesus gives the rod to rule the nations to the Christian. He says, see, you rule the nations. It's a good thing. And what Chris Vallotton didn't do was read not the next verse. He didn't even read the next clause in the same sentence, which is that Jesus gives you the rod to rule the nation, and you will smash it like a clay pot. The rod that rules the nations smashes the nations. It's from Psalm 2. Why do the nations rage in vain? The rod is a symbol of authority, and the earliest believers, the earliest followers of the way of Jesus, knew that the healing of the nation was their dissolution. In the book of Revelation, when the rulers lift off their crowns and throw them at Jesus' feet, that is the point of their healing. When they give over the symbol of their sovereignty and their independence. The nations are not good. They are part of the fabric of creation that the Lord is redeeming, that he's weaving together. And to talk about nations as if they are the ultimate end and as if they are what you should find your identity in, what you should die for, and what you should kill for, is to create a god out of a thing that was invented by human tradition and shared collective imagination. It's to make a god out of something. It's to give that thing in which you live and move and have your being. And these nations are precisely the thing that the New Testament spends a lot of time trying to downgrade, trying to prize apart the individual's identity from their prior nations. There is no barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but now you are in Christ. And so the idea that your nationhood deserves your utmost allegiance was directly counteracted by the New Testament. Which is why I think the word Christian is so pointless now. Because the word Christian often effectively just means a good patriot or a good citizen or a good member of your culture that you're born into. And even when it doesn't mean that, the people who call themselves Christians often are putting the most, their best and brightest energy and money and resources and time and talent, and including their own children, they are giving them over to the service of the nation, to patriotism. It's the rival god. And in fact, patriotism is the most successful ideology. It's more successful than the gospel. It doesn't make it true. Just because a thing is more popular doesn't make it better. Back in the day, Baywatch was the most popular television program in the history of the world. Didn't make it any good. So patriotism is far more popular, far more powerful. It has much of a stronger command on the hearts and minds of people. Much stronger than the gospel. Much stronger than the gospel of peace. Because, like I said, you will see people will talk about Jesus or pay lip service to Jesus, and then at the first hurdle, at the first time when their property or land or family is in danger or when their country is in danger, they will throw over the way of Jesus and they will find the way of the world instead. And they will embrace it, and then they will find ways to justify that. But the way of the world is to defend what is yours and what you think is rightfully yours. It's to group together with people who sound like you and look like you as much as possible, and it's to use lethal violence in the maintaining of order and in the defense of those things. And these are the opposite of the way of Jesus. I don't know how else to keep saying it. This is why nationalism and patriotism are inimical to the way of Jesus. They are actually opposite to it. And it's so hard to hear this. Christians don't believe it. They cannot believe that patriotism is a vice. And they all immediately think, oh, well, you must mean the Nazis or you must mean the nationalists. My patriotism is fine. But it's not fine. Because your patriotism has as its end the killing of enemies and the exclusion of foreigners and the shoring up of resources for people who look like you and sound like you as much as possible. Which, don't get me wrong, is absolutely necessary for the running of a country as we have built them. But all that shows me is that countries require practices which Jesus explicitly said to his followers not to do. Which tells me that patriotism is a problem. That your job in this world is not to make your country the best country it can be. Your job in this world, if you're a follower of Jesus, is to expand his kingdom. And his kingdom was seen by his followers and was seen by people around as being an alternative to the other kingdoms, a daily lived experience, which manifests itself directly in terms of how they relate to their enemies by refusing to kill them, how the earliest followers of Jesus dealt with money by giving it away so that there was no poor amongst them, how the earliest followers of Jesus dealt with racial and ethnic boundaries and barriers by breaking them down constantly, fighting for it. Most of the New Testament books, the engine driving them is an attempt to dismantle ethnic and racial prejudice and privilege. I'm going to stop here for this session. If you are interested in this, there's a lot more material on it. Obviously, I would recommend that you go to the Nomad podcast and find the episode where I speak for God and country. Speak about this stuff at length. I'll see you in the next episode.